Welcome to the show, everybody. I do hope that you have been enjoying yourselves in my absence, but I have returned. And with my return, I brought with me once again another monster. For those of you just joining me today, this is, again, Dallas Duclo, host of the Bareback Facts. And today we're going to be talking about the Knuckle of E. But before we do, I want to welcome you all to the show. If it's your first time, remember that I have a call-in number at 718-508-9883. Feel free to call in anytime. Let's just keep things about what we're talking about. Or if you guys would like to talk about other things, feel free to bring those to the table as well. All I ask is that you keep it friendly and appropriate, and let's have a little fun. Today, as I mentioned, we're returning to mythology. We'll be talking about the Knuckle of E. Today's show is not going to be particularly long. There's not a lot in regards to this written down, so we won't be spending too much time about it. But we are going to talk about mythology as a concept and why mythology is important, even when it comes to these sort of fictitious and made-up creatures. These stories are the big stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. You guys have heard me say that a number of times, and I want to get to the heart of that when it comes to mythology and what that means. So without further ado, let's get started, shall we? So what exactly is the Knuckle of E? The Knuckle of E is a horse-like demon that comes from Orcadian mythology, and it combines equine and human elements. It has its origins in Norse mythology and is the most horrible of all the demons of Scotland's Northern Isles. The Nook component of its name may be cognate with Nick in Old Nick, a name for the Christian devil. The Knuckle of E's breath was thought to wilt crops and sicken livestock, and the creature was held responsible for a number of terrible natural disasters. The creature itself is shrouded in mystery. So let's get to some of the key terms in regards to the Knuckle of E. So what exactly is Orcadian myth? So if you're not familiar with the term Orcadian, this term is in reference to the Orkney Islands, which come from the Old Norse word Orkneyjar. It's an archipelago in the Northern Isles of Scotland, situated off the north coast of Great Britain. It's approximately 10 miles north of the coast of Caithness and comprises approximately 70 islands, of which 20 are inhabited. The largest island, mainland, is often referred to as the mainland, and it has an area of 520 square kilometers, for those of you who are keeping count, making it the sixth largest Scottish island and the 10th largest island in the British Isles. The largest settlement and administrative center is known as Kirkwall. Now, a form of the name dates to the pre-Roman era, and the islands have been inhabited for approximately 8,500 years, originally occupied by the Mesolithic and Neolithic tribes, and then later by the roaming, ravaging tribe known as the Picts. Orkney was invaded and later forcibly annexed by Norway in 875 and settled by the Norse. The Scottish Parliament then re-annexed the earldom to the Scottish crown in the year 1472, following the failed payment of a dowry for James III's bride, Margaret of Denmark. Orkney contains some of the oldest and best-preserved Neolithic sites in Europe, and the heart of Neolithic Orkney is a designated UNESCO World Heritage Site. So this is a place shrouded in, is steeped just absolutely to the brim in history. I mean, this is a place that's been inhabited by people for nearly 9,000 years by multiple different groups, by different groups of people, ranging from the roaming hunter-gatherer tribes and to eventually the Picts, who called it home, and then eventually the Norse, and then finally the Scottish again after they retook the islands. So this is a place that has been not only an area of great deal of cultural shifts, but also it's an area that has a good deal cultural exchanges. Because of how many times it's changed hands, we have a plethora of different stories and myths and legends and historical events that take place all around this area. So it's going to be it's a great place to find a creature as mysterious as the Nuckleavee, which happens to just be one of many, many creatures from myth and one of the many stories that come out of this area. So now that we know a little bit about this place, let's get a little bit deeper into the Nuckleavee. Now, creature itself is said to have breath that is capable of wilting crops, sickening livestock, and killing people, basically delivering plagues upon people. The creature was held responsible for not only the outbreak of disease and the death of crops, but droughts and epidemics on land, despite its predominantly being associated with the sea. Something very odd there. Now, a graphic description of the Nuckleavee as it appears on land was given by an islander who claimed to have had a confrontation with it, but accounts describing the details of the creature's appearance are quite inconsistent, as they generally end up being with creatures such as the Nuckleavee. In common with many other sea monsters, it is unable to tolerate fresh water. Therefore, those it is pursuing have only to cross a river or stream to be rid of it. Now, before we pursue this any further, I would like to point out that this creature, as a sea monster of sorts, is said to not be able to tolerate fresh water. This is a common trope when it comes to sea monsters, such as kelpie, mermaids, and the like. But in addition to that, it's also a spiritual thing. For those of you who don't know, many pagan societies, many pagan cultures, that being Norse and Celtic, some of the roaming tribes of Europe, including the Roma, before they were becoming a little bit more Christianized, many people, particularly in Eastern Europe and Central Europe, believed that evil spirits could not cross water, that they could not cross clean water. So the best assured way of saving yourself from an evil spirit, at least according to many of these pagans from this time period, and this from more ancient times, they believed that by crossing over a body of water, they would be safe because water is pure. There's this element of water that is associated with being clean, that is associated with being pure and very calming. And thus, these chaotic beings cannot cross these things. They cannot cross over. Much in the same way that we see people who talk about the fact that you're able to supposedly ward off witches with salt. Newsflash, that probably wouldn't work out too well if there were witches intent on doing you harm. It probably wouldn't make much difference. Tell ourselves, give ourselves that nice peace of mind, right? There's got to be a weakness to the things that pursue us. So, back to the Nuckleavee, little sidebar there for you guys. The Nuckleavee itself is said to be kept in confinement during the summer months by the Mither of the Sea, an ancient Orcadian spirit and the only one able to control it. So what is the Mither of the Sea? This is another being that is associated with with Orcadian folklore. It's also known as the Sea Mither. It's a mythological being that lives in the sea during summer when she confines a demonic Nuckleavee to the ocean depths. Each spring, she battles with her archenemy, Terran, another spirit of Orcadian legend capable of causing severe winter storms to gain control of the seas and the weather. Eventually, Sea Mither overcomes Terran and sends him to the depths of the ocean, but the effort of keeping him confined there, along with her other benevolent labors during the summer, exhausts her until in the autumn. Terran then takes advantage of her weakness to wrest control of her once again, and the cycle continues on and on, thus explaining for many people during more ancient times the shifts in the climate of this region. Stories of the Sea Mither and Terran are common and are among Orkney's oldest legends, probably invented to explain the vagaries of weather and other naturally occurring events. In Shetland, fishermen petition Sea Mither to afford them protection from the devil. So little bit of extra cultural discussion there for you, a little bit of extra. I like to give. I'm a giver. So Orcadian folklore had a strong Scandinavian influence, as you might have guessed, based on the fact that the Norse, the roaming Norse who raided not only Britain but Scotland and Ireland for over a century, they left their mark on these islands, not just with the sword, but with their culture. And so Orcadian folklore has a very strong Scandinavian influence, and it may be that the Nuklevi is a composite of a water horse from Celtic mythology and a creature imported from the Norsemen. Now, as with similar malevolent entities such as the Kelpie, it is possibly offered an explanation for incidents that islanders in ancient times could not otherwise understand. So before we, you know, the Kelpie is yet another one of these seafaring beings cultivated by the Scots, and it's a shape-shifting water spirit inhabiting the lochs and pools of Scotland. It's described as being as bearing the appearance of a horse or a beautiful woman or young male, and by some accounts, it is said that this being lures people to the water and either drowns them or devours them at the bottom of these bodies of water, so making larger bodies of water a little bit scary. And more than likely a story designed to keep people, young people, from being unattended in these areas. Now, the late 19th century saw an upsurge of interest in transcribing folklore. But the recorders used inconsistent spelling and often frequently anglicized words. Thus, the same entity could be given different names. So when they say anglicized, what we mean is we're making things more English, right? We're putting them in terms that we can understand better. It's more of a transliteration than a translation. We're just going to take these words and we're going to give them more of an English tone so that we can kind of formulate the words a little bit better. And this happens a lot, particularly in the Isles of Britain, Scotland, and Ireland, when people are going back through old documents trying to make sense of them. The term Nuklevi derives from the Orcadian Nuglevi, and according to an Orkney resident and 19th century folklorist Walter Trail Denison, it means devil of the sea. Now, the same demon is called Muckalavi in Shetland, where it was considered as a nasty trow or sea devil. One Samuel Hibbert, an antiquarian of the 19th century, considered the component of Nook of the creature's name to be cognate with the devil, the old name for the devil, as I mentioned before, and with the Latin word Nacara, to kill. So essentially the devil who kills. Now, stories of mythical Orcadian demons are recorded in the 16th century Latin manuscripts of Joben, who may have been referring to the Nuklevi in his description of the Orkney island of Stronsay. Now, it's uncertain as to why Joben compiled the manuscript descriptions of Orkney, which provides a sequential account of the Orkney Islands and records details of traditions and development. Many suggestions have been made as to who he really was. Spran, one writer, states that. Oops, sorry. This guy's a little. Suggests that he was John Ballander and had been sent to carry out a survey of the islands. One historical geographer, Charles W.J. Withers, suggests he was John Benson or Beinstein, an Orkney bishop clerk, and local historian Sigurd Towery indicates he may have been John Bellenden or Ballenden, attributing the manuscript to the oldest surviving account of the Orkney Islands after they transferred to Scotland in the year 1468. Be that as it may, despite the fact we're not sure exactly who Joben was, we do know that these documents were written down, and they have been since transcribed by other writers as time has gone on. Now, much of the information available about the traditional tales told on Orkney, but to an extent, are romanticized and systematically altered certain elements of the stories in the process of transforming them into prose. So some of these writers who are taking them, again, are romanticizing them, and they are also anglicizing them, making them, putting them in terms that they can understand. Now, the Nuklevi, again, is a mythical sea creature that appears to be a horse-like demon when it ventures out onto land, sometimes appearing as a horse with no skin or a horse bearing a rider, both skinless, the rider sometimes carrying either a lance or a bloody sword, and then it tear asses across the land, wreaking havoc upon anything and anyone in its path. To be very similar to the Norwegian Nuk, the Nuggle of the Shetlands, and the Kelpie, a unique and solitary creature possessing extensive evil powers. Its malevolent behavior can influence events throughout the island. Islanders were terrified of the creature and would not speak its name without immediately saying a prayer. It was often found in the vicinity of a beach, but would never come ashore if it were raining. No tales describe what form it takes when it hits the sea, but its appearance on land has been recounted in graphic detail. One islander named Thomas claimed to have survived the confrontation with the beast, and after much cajoling by one Trial Denison, to whom the story was told to, reluctantly gave his description of the monster, the only known first-hand account. According to Tamis, the Nuklevi has a man's torso attached to a horse's back as if it were a rider. The male torso has no legs, but its arms can reach the ground from its position atop of the equine body, the legs of which have fin-like appendages. The torso has a large head and possibly as much as 3 feet in diameter that rolls back and forth. The monster described by Tamis has two heads. The equine head has an enormous gaping mouth that exudes a smelly toxic vapor and a single giant eye like a burning red flame. A particularly gruesome detail is that the Nuklevi has no skin. Black blood courses through yellow veins that stick out sharply upon its flesh, and the pale sinews and powerful muscles are visible as a pulsating mass. Other reports state that the creature resembles a centaur. Narratives are inconsistent in the finer details of the demon's description, however. Thyle Denison only describes a man's head with a mouth projected like that of a pig. Marwick also only mentions one head with a single red eye, and he borrows some of Tamis's characterization by recording the creature's mouth as like a whale's. Now, I want to put this into perspective for you guys. Here we have a situation where we're seeing numerous themes all kind of running ahead here. So those of you who've been keeping track of the show in the past know that I've talked about a great number of mythological beings that come from amongst Celtic and Norse folklore. In the past, I mentioned I had a long, drawn-out discussion about the demon king, Balor, king of the Fomorians from Celtic mythology. The demon king possessing a single eye that could unleash poison and flame and destruction upon the world when it opened due to being blinded in his other eye. But this single red eye that is said to bring destruction is a common theme that seems to pop up with the Nuklevi. In addition to that, we see the smelly toxic vapor, which can also be attributed to a number of beings within not only Celtic folklore, but also Norse folklore in the case of the Draugr, who are said to breathe noxious fumes from their mouths in some accounts. And for those of you unfamiliar with what Draugr are the corpses of undead, corpses of slain warriors and dishonored men who have come back to life to plague the living. So in many cases, these beings breathe noxious fumes that can befuddle a man. In addition to that, in Celtic folklore, we see many of their monsters breathe poison, and so do the monsters within Norse mythology. If we look at the story of Sigurd and in the Volsunga saga, and later in the readapted version, the Dasnivalungenlied, which is sort of an edited version of the Volsunga saga, but expanded with a different hero and a few new characters. We see that the dragon breathes poison and fire. So there's this association with serpents and the sea and monsters that breathe poison and flame upon their enemies. Now, why would these things be a concern? Why would these things pop up as common tropes? Well, if we look at these cultures objectively, and we look at some of the values and some of the things that they might have found terrifying, we're looking at two societies. In the case of the Celts and some of the more land-bound cultures of this time period of early history, particularly in Europe, you're looking at people who land the land. And so anything that is going to damage their crops potentially, that is going to kill their livestock, would be terrifying. And it comes to it, what kinds of things can do that? Well, obviously disease can cause your plants to die, and can cause your animals to die, can cause your relatives to die. And if you see your community stricken with an unknown disease, something you haven't encountered before, everybody has got this same malady, you don't know where it came from, you're going to start trying to find solutions to the problem. But if you don't have access to medicine, and the knowledge that we have access to today, you might come up with a story to explain what has happened and try to find ways around, to avoid this occurring again. And so it's not a surprise that we have the formulation of monsters that breathe poison that can kill everything around them, because what is disease if not poison that can kill everything that around it? I mean, disease, germs, they infect people, they spread, and when they do, kill animals, they kill plants. These things cause us to get sick, and it's like a domino effect. And for those people who are not familiar yet with germ theory, which many of these cultures were not yet familiar with germ theory, they were not yet familiar with germs and the concept of microbes and sicknesses, they just explained the world in the best ways they had the ability to do. So this is the kind of thing that you're going to see crop up a lot in these cultures. And also, a little side note here as well, you're going to see beings that exude poison and pestilence on people in many cases because of the culture. There was a common misconception about Vikings for a very long time that they were dirty, smelly, burly men, when in reality, at times they were probably dirty and sweaty, but they were actually pretty big on their hygiene. And why? Because they had the go around a lot of people that they didn't know a lot of times, and in addition to that, they didn't want to get sick, and they knew that by keeping clean and staying healthy, they could be better raiders. You know, the healthier you are, the easier it is to kill people. So, you know, that just made sense to them. But it's not a surprise. But it should come as no shock that monsters in these cultures are going to do. Are going to address concerns that they have. They're going to exhibit, if you will, talents and powers that highlight the anxieties that these cultures have. So when you're concerned about disease, when you're concerned about pestilence of your crops, when you're concerned about fire destroying your community, which in many cases during earlier times in our history, a fire could be quite devastating. I mean, now fires are can still be quite dangerous. I mean, people do die in fire still today, but I mean, you look at our structures today, they're a lot more sound than they used to be. And it, you know, this is a time before insurance, a time before you had the ability to bounce back easily from, more or less easy from losing everything in a fire. We very often don't lose everything. You know, you can bounce back a little bit. Fire breaking out in a community in the 16th or the 14th or the 12th or the 10th or the 9th century, or even earlier than that, could be devastating. Not only could it kill a lot of people in the community, it could later result in the later deaths of people in the community because they don't have access to the same things we do. And every resource that they do have access to, they're desperate to keep hold of. So just a little bit of nuggets there for you guys as to why these things would create anxiety for people and why these monsters that they're formulating possess the abilities that they do. Now, when we look at the Nuklevi itself, again, was thought to have a breath that could wilt crops and sicken livestock, and it was considered to be responsible for epidemics and droughts, seaweed burning to create what was known at the time as kelp began on Stronzai in 1722, and the product, soda ash, was an alkali mainly used to treat acidic soil, although as time went on, its commercial importance in soap and glass manufacture increased. The pungent smoke emitted during the process was believed to enrage the Nuklevi, resulting in a wild rampage of plague. The Deathklevi was said to have infected horses on Stronzai with a deadly disease known as mortachine, now commonly known as glanders. To demonstrate its fury and exact its revenge upon the islanders for burning seaweed, the infection subsequently spread to all the other islands involved in the industry, and the creature was also blamed for prolonged periods of abnormally low rainfall leading to water shortages and poor harvests, according to the work of Marwick. Now, let's look a little bit at what this malady that is plaguing people does. So what is it that this disease does to people? Glanders comes from an old French word, glandres, meaning glands. Glanders is endemic in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Central and South America, and it has been eradicated from North America, Australia, and most of Europe through surveillance and the destruction of affected animals and import restrictions. What does it do? It is an infectious disease that primarily occurs in horses, mules, and donkeys, and it can be contracted by other animals such as dogs, cats, goats, and humans. It is caused by infection with the bacterium Bucholderae malleae, usually by ingestion of contaminated feed or water. Now, signs of glanders include the formation of nodular lesions in the lungs and ulceration of the mucous membranes in the upper respiratory tract. The acute form results in coughing, fever, and the release of an infectious nasal discharge followed by septicemia and death within days. In the chronic form, nasal and subcutaneous nodules develop, eventually ulcerating. Death can occur within months while survivors act as carriers. So glanders can, in fact, be a very deadly disease if you contract it. Now, how does one bacterium Bucholderae malleae? It is able to infect humans. And transmission occurs by direct contact with infected animals, and entry is through skin abrasions, nasal and oral mucosal surfaces, or by inhalation. So basically, this kelp that these people were burning at the time of this epidemic that the Nuklevi is being blamed for in the 1700s, in 1722, the kelp industry is taking off. To create soap and glass, they're using this to also treat their soil. So this is getting into their water, it's getting into their food, and the animals are getting infected by the fact that they're burning this kelp. The kelp has the bacteria in it, the burning seaweed to turn it into kelp. It has this bacteria in it. The bacteria then becomes airborne. It infects their animals, the animals, or they are in contact with their livestock, and thus they're getting sick, and they are then passing it on and passing it on. So this disease that the Nuklevi is being blamed for is caused by humans, and yet they have created this concept of this Nuklevi because they didn't know. They didn't know what was causing this, and they had to invent a demon to explain it. Now, the Nuklevi is the most malevolent of the demons in and around the Scottish Islands. Without any redeeming characteristics, the only entity able to control it is the Mither of the Sea. Now, before we continue on, I do want to remind you all of our sponsor. We do have a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's wacky, he's crazy, and he's funny. Check out ChrisBraleyPresents.com. Guys, we're going to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up our discussion of the Nuklevi. As I said at the outset of the show, today's show is going to be short, and then we're going to talk a little bit about mythology and why we invent the stories we invent about ourselves. So, when we come back...
I'm Black Man, saving mankind, one stereotype at a time, to the Black Mother.
to the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFarleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin on the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the word from our sponsors and a little breather there. So we were talking about the Knuckle of E, and we visited some ideas about the Knuckle of E and the associations with disease and how people are explaining away this terrifying epidemic that's taking place. So I mentioned before, it's the most malevolent. This demon is said to be the most malevolent of all the demons in and around the Scottish Isles. Now, supposedly, according to this eyewitness by the name of Tamas, he encountered this exceptionally terrifying being, common with mythical sea monsters, with the possible exception of Kelpies and the Nuggle of Shetland. It is unable to wade through fresh flowing water. So, knowing this, Tamas managed to escape the Knuckle of E after he inadvertently splashed it with water from the lock he was alongside. That was quick thinking on his part. This briefly distracted the monster, allowing him to run over to a nearby channel of fresh water and jump to safety on the opposite bank. Now, as I mentioned before, many times in history, malevolent creatures are invented. They are created to explain away things that are otherwise unable to be explained. Why are bad things happening in our community? Could it be our fault? Absolutely not. It could never be our fault because we're such good people. So obviously, there's demons. Obviously, there are evil things that want to make our lives miserable. It could not possibly be due to our own stupidity that bad things are happening to us. It could not possibly be that we don't fully often understand the repercussions of our actions when we commit them, and therefore bad things happen as a result of us not seeing the whole picture before we commit to actions. So because those things are in many cases in the minds of most people impossible, we must therefore explain our situation and our predicament in another manner. How do we explain it? We invent monsters and gods so that we can explain why things are the way that they are. Because accepting responsibility and trying to understand things for what they are is often more complex or too hard for people to accept. As one Jack Nicholson would say in the famous scene from As A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. In many cases, beings are unable to grapple or handle the truth. They are unable to come to terms with the truth. And because of this, in many cases, because people overlook what they're doing, because they see the ability to make fast capital and not the fact that there could be repercussions for what they do, or they don't fully understand the implications of their actions in many cases. So oftentimes we overstep our bounds. As people, we've all done this. We've all done this. We've all made this mistake of not really fully understanding the gravity of a situation or not really fully understanding what we're doing. We see a task. We want to complete the task. We see potential for something positive, and we want to acquire that positivity, and we are willing to overlook things to do those things. We're also willing to cut corners to get our solutions, and in many cases, we end up meddling with things without fully understanding what the consequences could be or simply not caring until the consequences come into play. In 1722, when people were burning seaweed to create kelp and to create soda ash in order to make soap and glass and to treat acidic soil. Now, this seemed like a good idea at the time. Somebody burned some seaweed, they created some soda ash, and they realized, hey, this is really good stuff. This really works for the soil. What they didn't take into account is what could possibly be lying dormant within seaweed that's just been kind of floating around in a dirty ocean or just kind of laying around, where bacteria of all shapes and sizes could be making their nice tidy homes in, just waiting to get out. And in this case, the people of Stronce created their own epidemic. Now, because they had no idea that that was even possible to do, because they had no concept of what this disease was, because they'd never encountered it, and because they didn't see anything wrong with burning seaweed, because how could they? They'd never burned it like that before. They felt like they could do it without really taking into account of what could possibly be lying hidden within, because they didn't know about such things. They didn't really have any concept of such things. They had passing or vague familiarity with illnesses and maladies of the past, but they didn't really have a full grasp of the concept of bacteria and how they can spread. They didn't really have that down yet. And so because of this, they unleashed an epidemic upon themselves. And rather than say, hey, you know, things weren't really this bad, people weren't getting sick like this until we started burning seaweed, they just kind of said, how could this happen? Must be demons. I mean, it's got to be. Gotta be that damn knuckle of E. Couldn't possibly be the fact that we're burning some strange refuse that we've never burned before. Nobody sat around and said, I wonder if it was that seaweed crap we were burning. Nope, demons. And that's what you gotta love about some of these mythological stories. Oftentimes, the monsters we create and the stories we create are often a lot scarier than what is the actual cause of our current predicament. Now, in the case of Tamas, he goes for this hook, line, and sinker. Perhaps he did see something. Perhaps it was a striking fancy that he saw this being, the Knuckle of E. Perhaps he'd heard descriptions of it in scary stories that he'd heard, and he simply imagined it. We'll perhaps never know because he was the only guy there, and he's long dead. However, historians and psychologists tend to agree on this, that malevolent creatures in folklore and legend tend to serve as either allegories for obstacles or to serve as potential explanations for incidents that people from these times were otherwise unable to account for. Many ancient myths are based upon the natural elements of the turbulent and ever-changing seas. Established Orcadian tales were strongly influenced by Scandinavian mythology with a blending of traditional Celtic stories. And so the Knuckle of E may have its roots in a mythical creature imported by the Norsemen, fused with a traditional Celtic water horse. It's not unlikely that they saw stories that were similar, and they simply combined them to explain their current situation. With that being said, you look at the Knuckle of E, there are numerous descriptions of it. This thing is absolutely terrifying, the way that it is described, the skinless man, a horse thing. According to reports of this creature, the Knuckle of E has an aversion to running water, and those who are chased by him have only to cross a stream to be rid of him. Some reports claim that he is simply a very large head on two arms with all of the other characteristics we've talked about. Pale skin or no skin, an eye that burns with a single red flame, an enormous gaping mouth, a centaur-like body, black blood coursing through yellow veins and pale sinews and powerful muscles are visible upon him like a pulsating giant mass of exposed flesh and tendons. Now, according to legend, the other fear of the Knuckle of E is the smell of burning seaweed to create kelp. This is said to enrage the Knuckle of E, sending it into a fit of rage that he would go on killing fields of cattle. In this rage is the Mither of the Sea. Knuckle of E's are said to be strongly built and stand either 6 to 9 feet with a weight of nearly 2,000 pounds. Oddly specific. Now, the Knuckle of E itself has appeared in numerous stories. What we do know is that the Knuckle of E is not without its merits as far as the story goes. Now, the Knuckle of E was feared by the people of Orkney. His breath was said to be like a poison that caused harm to livestock and caused crops to fail. He was also considered to be responsible for epidemics and droughts. It was said that there was nothing more infuriating to the Knuckle of E than the burning of seaweed to produce kelp, which I find odd, since, you know, humans were doing that and killing themselves, but okay. Now, a method used in Orkney from the early 18th and with increasing frequency until the early 19th century, ash produced from burning kelp was rich in potash and soda, substances sought at the time by the glass and soap industries. Now, the Knuckle of E hated the smell of this smoke, and it drove him into an uncontrollable rage. But according to legend, it wasn't just this that drives the Knuckle of E into an unquenchable thirst for destroying everything around him. The Knuckle of E was said to cause as much harm as he could to the people and animals of Orkney, and was indeed an evil and malevolent creature. And it is said that even before the burning of the kelp, the Knuckle of E was responsible for every horrible thing that really happened to the people of Orkney. So this tells us that perhaps the Nuklevi had been a lot more established even before the 1700s, and therefore that this horrendous thing happened, but it was one thing that was simply a line of bad things that happened that we couldn't explain, so we're just going to blame it on this guy. So what does that tell us about human nature? What does it tell us about the importance of mythology? Well, the importance of this story is that despite the fact that it doesn't explain the various maladies that plague people of Orkney, nor does it explain this particular incident in Stronsay in 1722, what it does do is give us insight into the minds of the people in this place. And what it tells us about them is that they not only are incredibly inventive, but it also tells us that when they can't explain something, they are willing to go to great lengths to try and figure out how they can explain it. It tells us about the ingenuity of the human spirit, and it's about how willing people are and have been throughout history to exonerate themselves of responsibility by creating entities of a supernatural nature or of a higher power than themselves. This reliance on something outside of ourselves to be responsible for the things that we either do or the things that happen to people, or in a way to explain natural disasters out of our control in order to feel like we have more control over our domain than we actually do, all point to the fact that human beings suffer from a desire and an absolute need to be able to not only explain the world around them at all times, but to feel like they can control what is around them at all times. The creation of myths such as the Nuklevi tells us that human beings are desperate to explain the universe in any way they can. Find a way to explain it. And if science doesn't provide answers, mythology and religion are quick to jump in and provide the answers you seek. If religion and mythology cannot provide the answers, the same is true of science, and the same is true of philosophy. Philosophy, science, religion, mythology, these are all tools created by humanity to grapple with the things that they are not yet able to comprehend on their own without the aid of some form of exposition and some form of semantics. Human beings are desperate to explain the unexplainable. They are desperate to find solutions to problems at any cost. And in some cases, this is a good thing. In some cases, it leads to vast technological and medical advances. In some cases, it leads to tremendous achievements. But in some cases, it only hurts us because our desperation to explain things without fully investigating them at times causes us to hit major pit. Fortunately for us, in many cases today, people dedicate themselves to science when it comes to problems that we can't yet explain. They dedicate themselves to researching the problem and figuring it out at its core to find the actual source of a problem. And this is a good thing. This is called using deductive and inductive reasoning. This is called using our brain to solve the problems, to go directly to where the problem started. We start there, and then we try and find out how we can fix it. That is using reason and logic to figure out solutions to problems. And that is going to take us a lot farther now than the creation of myth. Does that mean that creation of mythology and religious ideologies or philosophical ideologies that help us explain our universe have no value? It absolutely does not mean those things have no value. Mythology tells us stories about ourselves to ourselves. It tells us what is important to us. It captures many tropes and themes that we can learn from, that tell us what cultures value. And that's important. It tells us what morals are valued, what things are considered reprehensible to our culture, and it tells us a little bit about why. Religion does much the same thing. It gives you a compass. It gives you an idea of the kinds of things that certain people and certain cultures are willing to accept and the kinds of things that they're not willing to accept. In addition to that, it gives us insight into what is valuable to a culture, what is valuable, what is important to us. Well, how do we know what's important to us? Religion tells us what's important to us. And then we get to philosophy. Philosophy shows us the kinds of questions we should be asking. It tells us the kinds of questions we should be asking and the kinds of questions we find important to ask about the universe. It tells us that we are still trying to find the answers. Philosophy tells us we're trying to find the answers. Religion tries to offer the answers, and mythology tries to fabricate the answers. So those three things do have value and they do have merit. And consider them pieces of the process of constructing what we know as human understanding. They're various tools of human understanding. They are mechanisms of understanding our world. And they have shaped and created various worldviews. And they continue to do so to this day, and they will continue to do so in the future. That's all I've got for you guys today on the Knuckle of E. I told you guys that it would be a short show, and I'm sticking to it. Today is a short show. It's good to be back. Hope you guys will tune in next week for my exclusive interview with Freya Alley. She's signed with the same record label as Sam Smith and Pixie Lott. Hails from Lithuania. Tremendous vocalist. We're going to be talking about her single, Come Back, and we're going to be talking about her work and her goals in the music industry. That's going to be next week at 4 p.m. Eastern time, guys. So I hope you guys enjoy that. Something to look forward to in the near future. This has been another edition of the Bareback Facts. I'm your host, Alice Duclos, and I hope you guys have enjoyed the show. If you're looking for more information on the Knuckle of E and where you can look into this tremendously entertaining legend, I've got you covered. Fear not, I can point you in the right direction. So, the first place that I would recommend that you take a look at, I would suggest that you take a look at the Sea in Orkney Folklore from OrkneyR.com. I would also recommend that take a look at the work of Ernest W. and Shetland, published in 2000. Patricia Monaghan, The Encyclopedia of Celtic Mythology and Folklore. Orkney Folk Tales by Tom Muir. Trial Denison Walter. Orkney Folklore, Sea Myth, The Scottish Antiquary, or Northern Notes and Queries from Edinburgh University Press. And Jennifer Westwood, as well as Sophia Kingshell's The Lore of Scotland, A Guide to Scottish Legends. Guys, that's all I've got for you today. Check out some of those texts if you're interested in learning more about the Knuckle of E. And if you're just interested in Scottish and Celtic mythology, these are a good jumping point for you. And I hope that you'll take the time to engage with it. That's all I've got. See you all next Wednesday for our exclusive with Freya Alley. Enjoy the rest of your week, guys.